You've heard from two streams that met together with the passage of Medicare and created something that was totally unpredictable. They created a children's crusade. And let me explain what actually happened, because it's one thing to pass legislation, it's another thing to implement it, and to implement it particularly in relationship to Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. The assumption, of course, was that Title VI of the Civil Rights Act really didn't mean anything in terms of the implementation of Medicare. The assumption, there was no debate about its implications in terms of the implementation of Medicare in the legislation. There was very little conversation about it. It was basically ignored. What do I do? This one?
Down arrow, yeah.
Okay. Okay. I'm probably the only speaker that came here on his own dollars, not even his university dollars, so I'm free to say whatever the hell I want.
Amen. So just hit the down arrow.
Okay. We have these two streams that are coming together that have really had nothing to do with each other up until the implementation of the Medicare program, represented by Wilbur Cohen and Robert Ball, expert craftsmen and technicians within the federal government. And we have the National Medical Association and the activists connected to that that have been working for a long time on these issues. The only representative at the medical representative at the signing of the Medicare bill was the president of the National Medical Association, Monty Cobb, who was invited to fly with Johnson to the signing ceremony at Truman's Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri. None of the representatives of hospitals in this country, none of the representatives of organized mainstream medicine participated in that signing ceremony. And probably Harry Truman would have blocked them from coming in if they had arrived, because he was still totally pissed off at the way they had treated him and his national health insurance bill that failed in 1948. I want to give you the other thing I want to kind of mention is that I think our spokesperson from the National Medical Association isn't really giving them enough credit. The entire civil rights movement owes a debt to the physicians in the National Medical Association, because almost everywhere in the South, the leadership of the local civil rights groups, the local chapters of the NAACP, were their members, and we're the ones that really brought had the courage to bring the challenges that were necessary both in the courts, in terms of school desegregation, and in terms of other aspects of desegregating our society. I want to kind of remind you that the past is not dead. It's not even past. And really, the big picture is that our entire modern healthcare system in the United States was created during the formative years between 1896 and 1954, which were really the Jim Crow years, the separate but equal years. That separate was really equal. And the way we still think about finance and deliver health care continues to be shaped by what happened in those formative years. And we still have the same battles. Okay. The irony of this picture of the opposition that was part of the American Medical Association's effort to keep politics out of the picture of medical care is that by the time they used this in their effort to defeat national health insurance in 1948 was that the only physicians that could be represented in this picture were black physicians that were denied privileges to hospitals in their area. And because of that denial, they were free to act as activists. There was nobody that was going to punish them by kicking them off their medical staffs or refuse to have them as participants in a health insurance program that they were not even eligible to receive payments from. And so the irony is that all of the resistance actually created some real power. Okay. Disagreed Memorial Hospital, it was completed in 1954, the year that Brown decision was made, and it has two twin towers. The only thing integrated was a sewage system. It was separate but equal, and this was the plan. We will defend this against integration to our death. Okay, and the battle over even this public hospital, which in theory should have come under the Brown decision, lasted for another decade, and it lasted even longer for most of the voluntary hospitals in the country that argued that they were really private organizations and did not necessarily need to comply. Okay, well, we have all this leading up to the passage of Medicare, and the assumption by the end of 1965 was that Medicare was going to have basically really little impact in terms of desegregated hospitals. That hospitals were going to follow the same pattern that the schools had followed after the Brown decision, and there may be some modest plans by hospitals to begin to integrate, but there was not going to be anything in terms of real integration taking place for a long time. It was really a mission impossible. There was a decision that was made that there wasn't going to be all deliberate speed as there was in the school desegregation situation. That hospitals wishing to participate would have to be totally integrated. They would have to be fully compliant. There would be no exceptions. And there was a deadline of July 1, 1966 to become fully integrated. Compliance was going to be determined by an office only created in February 1966 with a staff of five and no possibility for any supplemental appropriation to expand that staff. There were 6,000 hospitals that had to be forced into compliance in less than 4 months, and about half of them were clearly resistant to this outside imposition of such a instant transformation of their operations. Okay, so there was no way this was gonna happen, right? It's gonna be impossible. Except what happened, of course, was Medicare and its implementation got captured by the civil rights movement. it was implemented, the No All the Liberty Speed decision was implemented by a group of civil rights activists in the secretary's office that said, this is what we're going to do. Hospitals had to be fully integrated. It was then enforced by 1,000 volunteer inspectors, partly from the Public Health Service and partly from the Social Security Administration, that were sent a memo that said, if you'd like to volunteer for this temporary assignment, we at HEW are now a civil rights organization. We, in effect, have been taken over by the civil rights movement. And if you would like to have whatever your office is that you're now in, will pay your expenses and pay your salary, but we're going to shift you to this particular assignment. Unbeknownst to the Appropriations Committees in the legislature, these people would be reassigned. Furthermore, you had an invisible army in every community. You had black physicians, you had black hospital workers, you had activists that made it virtually impossible for any institution to circumvent the requirements. In effect, you had a children's crusade. And many of the training sessions that the investigators went to were not staffed by hospital experts or physicians. They were people from the civil rights movement, CORE, SNCC, other groups that helped with their training. And then they were sent out to enforce some very precise and well thought through guidelines in terms of what this would mean. That meant you couldn't just take the white and colored signs off the doors. You had to make sure that everybody went in the same entrance. So that meant you would change one of the doors to an entrance, the other door to an exit, and fix the locks in such a way so people would have no choice, they would have to integrate. You could not have segregated waiting rooms, even if you didn't have signs. You had to create a situation where people were forced to, had no other choice than to sit together in the waiting room. Suppliers could not provide segregated products. Louisiana Red Cross blood supply was labeled white and colored, and a telegram was sent in late May to the Louisiana Hospital Association from one of the employees in the Office for Equal Health Opportunity that never even bothered to consult with legal counsel, said, in effect, all the hospitals in Louisiana are not in compliance with Title VI and will not be eligible for Medicare until the blood supply is changed. It took 6 hours to integrate the blood supply. The other concern was related to medically vulnerable people, old people that wake up in a bed and discover they were in a room with somebody of the opposite race. It would kill them. There was an accommodation that was made that said that if the physician would certify to that effect in a form that he would have to fill out, the attending physician, then they would move the person. Well, physicians hate to fill out any more forms than they actually have to. And in this particular case, they were particularly embarrassed. And this particular part of this accommodation was rarely dealt with. And there were some issues related to medical referrals to different hospitals, but that's a much longer and complicated story that is still going on today. Okay, well, basically what happened? A miracle happened. There was elimination of all the symbols of racially and economically divided hospital systems that exist in this country. Hospitals up into the passage of Medicare have been the most racially segregated and economically segregated institutions in our society. After the implementation of Medicare, and indeed, even today, they are now our most racially and economically integrated institutions. Furthermore, access to care on the basis of need, not race or economic resources, suddenly existed. It was not only when I went to graduate school at Michigan, we were taught that access or use of services was directly related to income and inversely related to need. The implementation of Medicare and Medicaid transformed all that. Okay, that's the good news. The bad news is that we ended up with a rather peculiar accommodation to all this stuff. And one of the things that has resulted is a partial resegregation of care. We've reduced the length of stay and the bed supply of hospitals in this country. Sort of like that little clip you saw by Jack Geiger, that most of the patients now in hospitals are comatose, so they don't even know who's in the bed next to them. So we have a much shorter length of stay, and we're discharging people that probably shouldn't be discharged, and now the big issue is all the stuff about returning readmissions before 30 days to people that have been discharged. The other thing that happened, of course, with Medicare and was on it, ironically subsidized by Medicare, is the creation of a large proportion of our beds that are private room accommodations. So the issue of racially matching patients did not come up. And we had a massive growth of the nursing home sector and a great expansion and growing pressure on ambulatory and home care service, all in a sense partially resegregating care and creating a lot of other kinds of problems as well. Okay, lessons for the Affordable Care Act. The keys to the Medicare Title VI victories, I think, are really flawed. First, there was absolute precision and consistency. This is what you have to do. You have to randomly assign patients to rooms. You can't get away with bluffing. You can't push us. We won't let you do that. You have no choice. Or rather, you have a choice, either as a provider or as a patient. You can be a participant in the Medicare program, or you can choose not to participate in the Medicare program. If you don't want to participate in the Medicare program, that's fine. If you do, you have to accept that we are all, for the first time in this country, in it together. And there's no choice. Hospitals responded to the golden rule. The golden rule is those that have the gold rule. And in this case, Medicare and eventually Medicaid made it very clear that this is, you wanted the money, this is what you have. And administrators even got fired by their boards because they refused to move quickly enough to assure the flow of the Medicare dollars. The other thing that's really not really understood, and that is that there was a pre-existing administrative appeal process. If people were told that they were not in compliance with Title VI, just like people that have denied disability benefits, they could go through an administrative appeal process. The exact same administrative appeal judges that rule on cases related to disability now rule on cases related to Title VI. And so the hospitals had to go through a period of maybe 6 months of going through administrative appeals before they could even get to the courts. And that was too long to wait for the dollars. I cannot emphasize enough that none of this would have happened without the kind of moral passion, this tidal wave of passion that existed. These were lifer bureaucrats in Washington that volunteered to put their lives on the line. They did not worry about working 18-hour days to make sure that this thing worked. And there were people in these communities, particularly the black hospital workers, that were blowing the whistles, that were clearly in jeopardy of losing their jobs. But we are all in this together. And finally, all of this followed in the wake of a larger social movement that has at least partially begun to transform our country. And with that, a book related to this will be out in the spring, and hopefully it will also be accompanied by a documentary, which I think that Barbara would like those of you that have connections to help provide some of the stories that could be included in this undocumented and largely ignored part, important part of the history of the evolution of healthcare in this country. Thank you.
Okay. We have just a couple of minutes for questions, and there are microphones. Please use them. Yeah.
Make sure this one is
on.
I live in Chicago and work on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act here, and I've been putting in my own 18-hour days for the last 5 years on that. And I knew there was a story to the implementation of Medicare and Medicaid that we needed to understand what was happening with the Affordable Care Act. And so I just want to thank you for putting this on, because I needed this for like 4 years. And I'm grateful to be able to get it now and have some more trails to follow. The part I didn't understand was the intrinsic connection between the civil rights movement and the healthcare movement. And my section of ADA implementation work is around the justice system and getting better healthcare access for people leaving jails and prisons, and ultimately to use those resources to create diversion opportunities. And so that's what we've been putting our blood, sweat, and tears in. I just wonder, in the context of the whole history discussion we had this morning in the civil rights movement, if you all have thoughts about how those things should come together now in that flow of history around the justice.
Is it working?
Yes.
It is working.
I think the pieces are all there. They just have to come together. You're all there. This is what I still did not. It's a matter of welding those pieces together, and I think that there's still that kind of passion that exists, and there is still a belief. The Tea Party people who say keep the government off of my Medicare, what they're really saying is we need universal. We want to protect the universal care that we have, and we want to respond. And that's underneath all this other silly ideology that exists. It's still there. It's a matter of tackling each of that. And communicating the kind of passion the moral passion that existed then, and I think it's still there.
With regards to that, I see it as a true integration. It took the civil rights momentum to look at the issue of health inequity and what could be done in terms of the hospitals that were segregated and so forth, the people that couldn't get care. And I go back to the book, The Physicians, Black Physicians in the Jim Crow South by John Thomas Ward. If you can get that book, it gives you a good history. There were things that I saw in that book that I remember growing up in things and didn't understand how it originated. In other words, how some doctors had their offices in crack hospitals over funeral homes, or they had them over pharmacies. Well, that was because they could not use the other hospital. They couldn't even put a patient in their hospital. But yet, still, if you look at that trend and the fact that the Hillsburg Hospital, they were getting funds. So you had to really look at the reality and version. I guess when you look at the civil rights movement, it's all in terms of inequity and what doesn't make sense. And I guess you look at the healthcare as it was the big thing and just kind of say, this really doesn't make sense.
The point that I would make to you is to widen the conception of fair treatment from desegregation to segregation issues and think about the HCA from the standpoint of whether or not it does not have a conception of a common benefit for equally sick citizens. I think we've lost a good deal of the moral underpinnings in health insurance that are still there in equal treatment according to other criteria. I think that's a hugely important development of this kind of weakening of the treatment of medical care as a merit care rather than a market care, but that's a wider conception.
Okay. Good morning. Fantastic presentation all. Thank you so much. My question is about whether or not the people who were on the wrong side of the fight in the 60s, standing in the way of Medicare, whose progeny now have decided not to expand Medicare in the American South, in the large in the American South. Is it that they have learned the lessons very well about how it all works and have decided that they would, for that reason, come up with strategies that would be more effective, including these Supreme Court cases? And what is it going to take for the most vulnerable people in these states that have decided not to? What is it going to take in regards to the social movement, the grassroots movement that you have so eloquently described some 50 years ago? What will it take as far as the movement goes to convince those who are still convinced that expansion of Medicaid, socialized medicine, that they are going to pay like that?
I have to say I'm not perfectly clear about the question you posed. Say it simply in one sentence.
Okay. Those who, let me think in terms of just ask a simple question. Is there a comparable grassroots movement in our day to convince those who refuse to expand that game to change their mind?
Well, the point that I would make about the fight over Medicare is relevant today to the question you raised, is that there's no escape the huge gap between people who believe medical care ought to be treated like an ordinary market good and people who don't. People who regard it as something special, the allocated by ability and willingness to benefit, not ability and willingness to pay. And that we've lost our way. We never had much in the way of that fight in the first place, for reasons that I tried to suggest, because the original enemies were the conservative coalition, and the effort there was to bypass those arguments. I think in the absence of going back to basics, we will move more in the direction of allocating medical care by ability and willingness to pay, and it's the rediscovery of the underlying principles of equal treatment in the case of civil rights, but also equal treatment of equally ill people. That's been missing. If you think about the ACA, there's not one speech I can think of by a major American official that talks about what's different about medical care from the purchase of cars. And I think that's important.
I think that if you look at the map across the country, in terms of where resistance to at least the expansion of Medicaid is coming from, it's coming from exactly the same states that resisted the desegregation of the hospital. So the battle continues, and I think that it deals with the same issues. We have to decide as a country whether we're really all in this together or we're not. And Medicare, the implementation of Medicare made very clear that there should be no choice. You have to be all in this together. And now it needs to be a dwindling of that emphasis on that. Everything has to do with so-called your choice, which really is a way of reallocating people on the basis of income and disadvantage.
I agree with what has been said, and I just want to add this. You know, it seems that in terms of Medicaid, because I think that's what you were alluding to, it's just like a political hot potato, so to speak. And it's interesting to me that those states that don't want to expand Medicaid, and I work in one in Indiana, but they kind of changed it to some other name. You know, they wouldn't dare say that. They called it Temp Health in Indiana, like something like that, which is the same thing. But then they figured out, okay, but having said that, there are those states that won't do it. And it's politics, and some of it is. And I really think, to be honest, that the public sentiment has to swell of what is going on. And then when the election comes, both those people are out of office. If they don't stir the best interest of the masses, because you know they want to, I think, make like Medicaid is this white, this is this group, and it's not. If you look at who gets on Medicaid, it's majority white for the most part, the population. You see what I'm saying? They want to make it look like it's somebody over here doing anything, blah blah blah, and that's really not the case. I think the facts have to be there. the public outcry, as was done, you know, prior in the 50s and 60s and so forth. And then, if you have people who are in elected positions and they are not doing what needs to be done for the good of the masses of the people, then I think they need to be voted out in place.
Yeah, I'm just in favor of the First Amendment. Yeah, I'll just make the observation about the overlap between the expansion of Medicaid and the battle for voting rights in the United States.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Alex, last question.
Oliver Fine from Wild Cornell, Manhattan. I was wondering if the panel would speculate. I believe that Medicare is under a major challenge now to be privatized. And how do you see kind of fighting against that? What are the forces that might lead us to really talk in terms of expanding Medicare and improving it? Problems to the entire population. What rubric, what ways do you see that happening?
Thanks, Oliver, for that question. Can you hear me? Somebody well back there? I think a twofold strategy is called for. On the aggressive side, I think you need, on the part of policy commentators and analysts, full-scale attack on the premises of the view that private health insurance with differential policies should be given vouchers in place of Medicare. That's the underlying principle. It's called premium support, but in fact it's a voucher. And so the feature of a voucher is that it limits the government's financial responsibility, but doesn't limit the cost of Medicare. So, plain language, this marketing misrepresentation, an attack on Medicare's premise of being responsible for the payment for hospital care, in this case, subject to deductible and other limits. And I think I would go even further, which is to locate that particular expression of vouchers for Medicare called premium support in a wider sense, the celebration of market allocation in general. And attack that on the positive side of returning to the arguments about why it is professionals, that physicians, for example, would prefer a world in which they didn't allocate their services by ability and willingness to pay, and why that's an important element in the motivation of decent physicians in the first place. Apart from the attack of the underlying premises, on the more positive side, I think we have to go back to what considerations led in the first place to having a simple common benefit of 60 days of hospital care. Literally go back to the origins and say, what we need is a relook at Medicare to go back to a situation in which we simplify in light of its original aspirations. And know that its developments have produced not a monster, but an extremely complex scheme, illustrated by the fact that Aetna sent me a 90-page guide to my drug development. I mean, it's a caricature of what simplicity ought to be. In short, you need a double strategy. You need both attack the market premises of the private health insurance and their related ally in the wider politics. And on the positive side, you need to rediscover why there was an effort in the first place to make medical insurance closer to prepayment than it was to catastrophic health insurance, because what's going on in the private health insurance market is a kind of hollowing out of prepayment and a substitution of quasi-catastrophic. Lots more to say, but those are the two rubrics that I would put on.
I would just add that we really need to recover the language that existed before commercial insurance moved into the health insurance market in the 1940s and 1950s. to that point in time was assumed that healthcare was not a commercially insurable product. We have to get back to that idea of basically the soul of, we've sort of lost the sense of what the soul of insurance was. We were a cooperative pooling of resources to take care of those who really need help.
I think the contribution to your question has been made on.
Yeah, if there is any response to the kind of language that is being used around single payer, and kind of interesting that Bernie Sanders in his campaign has used that term, and there seems to be some of the residents with that conceptual framework.
Well, I don't know what evidence you could put forward about that. I regard single payer as an inadequate description of a reform idea. It's like talking about a person in terms of their neurology. It's important, but it's inadequate. And I would think that the early, what you need is a label that opens up the question of what are the principles you're in favor of. You think about the Canadian National Health Insurance, they're called Medicare. Nobody stops and says, Medicare tells you enough. There are five principles that every Canadian official can figure out. And we need the equivalent maybe applied to our Medicare. But I think Medicare no longer can work as the example of the aspiration. It's got to be the features of Medicare that you want have to be enumerated. And I think the rubric, universal health insurance or national health insurance, begs for more. It doesn't mislead, it begs for more. Single payer begs for more, but doesn't reveal it begging. It acts as if that's a description. That's a financing description. Very important, I agree. But this is an area that you and I may disagree on. But when I went to Oregon last week, talk to some medical groups, medical reform groups, I made this plea, and they were much more sympathetic to the effort to find both a label that is accurate, but inviting the discussion of what underlying principles make it actually viable and serious.
Okay. That's what you're for, discussion.
Absolutely.
Well, Oh, no, go ahead, please.
One thing. I ask your question. I think that having called a single payer universal, I think we will get to that. I think that's eventually going. I think it's going to evolve into that. If you look at some areas, if you look at England, for example, everybody has coverage. You have,
they call it the National Health Service.
National Service. And then you have those who have their own coverage and those who have something else. But the bottom line is everybody has the coverage. So I think that's what we will get to. There will be perhaps one level here, but I think the thing of Medicaid probably will go into a Medicare type of picture, which will be universal health plan. A lot of insurance companies sort of follow the template of what Medicare does. They follow the suit for it. If they bundle, they start producing insurance companies and so forth. So I think the premise is there, and over a period of time, I think it will evolve into a single system.
I want to thank you all again for coming, and like I said, if you have any thoughts about the documentary or you know stories or know people who have stories, please be in touch. Thank you.